So, I'm in a coffee shop, trying to make a story work, but the story won't work. I can almost taste it on the tip of my tongue slipping away. My tiny table is piled with old newspapers for reference. I know I need a shave. Soap, hot water, laundry, clothing, but I haven't got time for that right now. I've got to think, maybe if I write scene notes on little pieces of paper, I'll sort this out. So I scribble notes, organize some notes, rearrange some notes, tailor stupid notes up, and then I hear a hey! And I look up, and I see a super pretty lady dressed real nice. My eyes narrow suspiciously. But I know this woman. She's my wife, and she's with three other professionally dressed, sweet-smelling people. She points and tells them, "This is my husband." And the fancy people look at me, unwashed, surrounded in a nest of stained newspapers and balled up trash. They laugh together in unison like, they're in on the joke, husband. And I want to say something to them like a person would, but my mind hasn't made the switch from writing to talking yet, and I just kind of blink. And the people look uncomfortable as they realize she's serious. Now, instead of running away embarrassed like she doesn't know me, the pretty lady kisses me on the lips and says she's going to get me something to drink. The bewildered people back away slowly, and I know what they're thinking. They're thinking she could have done so much better. I know this, and I have to laugh because they are so right. Today, from WNYC, Snap Judgment proudly presents The Better Half. Amazing stories from real people who know full well that their better self is someone else entirely. My name is Glenn Washington. Remember to never hate the player, always hate the game. Because you're listening to Snap Judgment. Now, we're going to start off today's Better Half episode in Los Angeles with a love like you've never heard before. For Jim Bunkelman spoke to our own Julia DeWitt. Jim, take it away.
Abigail hid in closets a lot when she was a little girl. And she was really shy. She never came out if anybody else was around. And she stuttered so badly that you couldn't understand at all what she's saying. It was just total stuttering.
Abigail was a deathly shy kid. Talking made her so nervous that she stuttered almost incomprehensibly. Jim tried to teach her sign language, but they didn't get very far. He held out hope that maybe reading out loud or something would help her. And as for any child of the early aughts, the book to read Abigail was obvious.
So I read her Harry Potter. So she was just a huge fan of Harry Potter. And so when Harry Potter opened up, the first one, we were there the first day. And we were sitting there waiting for it, and there was this 10-year-old boy sitting one seat over from her. And they started talking about Harry Potter. And I was amazed because Abigail had never spoken to anyone else but me. That's the first time I'd ever seen her in that situation. So it was a really good feeling.
This was exceptional for two reasons. One was that Abigail was shy. The other reason was that Abigail wasn't actually a kid.
Kit had no idea. You know, he was talking to this 40-something-year-old lady, as far as he knew, but it was Abigail talking to him.
This 40-something-year-old lady was Jim's wife, Rhonda. She was petite, she had dark hair with some gray in it, a gap in her front teeth, and wrinkles around her eyes from years of smiling. But she was talking with a kid's voice, the voice of a kid she called Abigail. See, she was diagnosed with dissociative identity disorder. You might have heard it called multiple personality disorder. Doctors have different explanations for it, but for Rhonda, it meant that she expressed herself through a bunch of totally distinct personalities. Abigail, the little girl that loved Harry Potter, was just one of them. But Rhonda didn't call it a disorder. Instead, she just felt like she was a group of people all sharing one body. When Jim met her, he had no idea about any of this.
What she presented to the outside world was Rhonda. We met, she was the office manager at a production company.
Jim was a video editor, and when he'd go in for freelance jobs to Rhonda's office, they started to get to know each other, and they got to be friends. It wasn't until 2 years after they first met that they went on their first date.
Well, I'd started dating her, started seeing her, and I found out talking to her sister, and her sister said something about, said like split personalities and Rhonda.
Rhonda was scared Jim might leave her once he found out, but that was not Jim's reaction.
I just wanted to meet people.
And when, so just for somebody that's never seen this before, when she would do this, was it kind of like an instantaneous change in her facial expression, or like how does it happen? Like, what does it look like?
Now, that's the thing. And when it's called switching, with Rhonda, when she had switched, it was instantaneous. Her face would change, her body language would change, and her speech patterns would change pretty instantaneously.
It was in this manner, this sudden switching, that Jim watched Rhonda switch between her personalities right before his eyes.
There were some great meetings. There was one time I was sitting at the computer and Rhonda was sitting on my lap, and we were looking at some websites on science because, well, I mean, my background is in science, and Rhonda was really interested in that. And all of a sudden I noticed that there was someone new out. And I could tell when there was someone new, because it's like if you all of a sudden woke up in a strange place, you'd be looking around trying to figure out where you were and all that. So I realized that there was someone new. I asked him who it was. He said, Isaiah. It turns out that Isaiah was really interested in science. And he was observing this from inside. And he was just so interested, and he was leaning, and he said he leaned really far forward, and all of a sudden he was out. He just fell out. He says, I just falled out. So he fell out, and there he was in the front because he was so interested. And so I got to know Isaiah.
The more time they spent together, the more of these personalities he met. And there were a lot of them. There was Lizzie. She loved flowers. There was a little boy named Nicholas.
Nicholas decided that he and I would be interested in cars together because he liked cars. So he was my car guy.
There were triplets.
Natalie, Lola, and Nicolette.
Numbers was a little girl who only spoke in numbers.
So like when she was really happy and she was, felt safe, she'd say 2240 because that was the house address of the house. And 7-Eleven. Somehow that meant happy.
There was Jake and Jeremy, another set of triplets, Angela, Angelica, and Angelique.
There was Kashmir, who was a gay female. There were more kids than adults, but there were quite a few adults. The adults blended in with Rhonda more easily than the kids did. It was not such a change for the adults. Now, a lot of times I would meet the adults, but they wouldn't really come out a lot. There were a few that were just indeterminate ages. I had no idea. They didn't know either. But most of them were younger, either teenage, preteen, or little kids. And there were babies, too.
In total, Rhonda said that she had over 70 different personalities, which is far more than most people with her diagnosis. When Rhonda would switch between them, Jim says he could recognize almost all of them.
Sometimes a kid would want something, and they would feel that I would be more inclined to say yes to one of the other insiders, right? So they would pretend to be that person. They'd say, I'm so-and-so, and they would pretend to be that person, but I could tell by the differences that that wasn't her. I'd nail them on it, and then they'd laugh, and they said, well, oh, yeah, I'm pretending to be her. So
Rhonda explained to Jim that the different personalities were all aware of what was happening at any given time. So Jim could talk to anyone he wanted to, whenever he wanted to. But Rhonda also explained that she had the ability to block them out, which was especially important when it came to the kids.
For instance, when Rhonda and I were being intimate, the kids weren't there. It wasn't like I was, you know, making love to kids. And that was really a sure thing. I mean, that was a solid thing. And there were other times, like maybe if we'd be talking about something that would be what they call triggers, where it would bring bad feelings, you know, out, or I'd be talking about Rhonda's past history, the kids would be blocked off from hearing that.
The diagnosis of dissociative identity disorder has been controversial. One explanation for it is that it's a response to trauma. And Rhonda's childhood had been pretty terrible.
Her mom had Rhonda when she was 16. She married Rhonda's biological father. And shortly after Rhonda was born, her mom started showing signs of schizophrenia. Her mom was not really able to protect her. And when Rhonda was six, she first inadvertently said something that clued her mother into the fact that her father was abusing her, sexually abusing her. And her mom was like just freaked out. And her mom reported him to authorities. He was jailed. He was arrested and jailed. Health services came, took the two kids out of the household, put them in foster care that wasn't any better, and separated Rhonda and her sister. The individuals in the multiple system just develop spontaneously to take care of what the situation is. In other words, a lot of times they are protectors. A lot of times they're deflectors of abuse and things like that. Insiders, the people in the system, help save the system. They help save it, and they're heroes.
Like, for example, take Isaiah, the little boy that loves science.
Isaiah came out when Rhonda was moved from foster home to foster home. And one of the foster homes she was in, apparently the foster parents found out that she was there because her father had abused her. And so they decided that Rhonda was a sinner. So they would hold Rhonda down and beat her and read her verses from the Bible to try and save her because her father had abused her. And so Isaiah came out about that. They used to read verses from Isaiah in the Bible, and that's how he got his name. And he was really interested in science because science was the antithesis of the Bible. And that's how he developed. I got back so much love. So much. I mean, you know what it's like with, say, a little kid and you give them a present and how happy they are? You know, I had that all the time. And that was worth it. I wasn't taking care of them as a charity. I was taking care of them because I got so much back.
The more I talked with Jim, the more confused I got. What was hard to wrap my head around was that Jim, while maybe by some standards a little eccentric, is also a lovely guy with a big group of friends, a steady stream of work. He's present and with it. In a word, he's normal.
So you had no hesitations about this or no,
no.
Sort of...
I just remember that it was like, oh, you know, she's multiple. It made almost no impact on me.
There's so many parts of your story that make sense to me, even though your experience is so foreign. But I can't imagine not going home at the end of the day and going to my roommate and being like, so I found out that Jim has a bunch of other personalities.
Yeah.
And it's kind of crazy.
Well, I do remember like talking to some friends and saying that, you know, this girl I'm with has multiple personalities and it's really fascinating. But I wasn't shocked by it. You know, I mean, my background is physics, and you come across a lot of things in physics that just don't seem real. You know, it's like, what do you mean time slows down. How can time slow down? I mean, how can length contract as you approach the speed of light? Does that sort of help explain?
Yeah, no, totally. I think the thing is that there's a need to be like, why would one do this as opposed to the kind of why not?
Well, Rhonda was absolutely amazing, wonderful person, and we connected on so many different levels. The fact that she was multiple really had nothing to do with it. I mean, I was attracted to her before I found out she was multiple. And when I found out she was multiple, it didn't make a difference.
Do you feel like you can remember, like, the last thing you thought was weird? Like, is that a thing you even think ever?
No, I don't feel that way.
Jim and Rhonda eventually got married. They loved to go to live music together. They hosted these big parties on the weekends with DJs at their little Hollywood bungalow. They had a ton of friends. Some knew about the personalities. Some just thought Rhonda was kind of eccentric. The couple, along with Rhonda's many insiders, lived happily together for 15 years. Until one night, Jim heard a noise coming from Rhonda's room.
I slept in another bedroom because she snored so loud. I couldn't sleep with her. And I heard her yell. And so I got up and ran into the bedroom, and I found her on the floor. She was conscious, but she was very confused.
Jim got her in the car and to the hospital. Rhonda fell into a coma. She'd had a stroke. When she came to, the kids, the adults, all of her insiders were gone.
They didn't come out. They would normally come out all the time. They didn't talk to me. I knew ways to bring them out. I could say certain phrases, and there was no response from them. So I knew that they weren't around. It was almost I was so involved in trying to get her better and take care of her that was my focus, and that's what we were doing. But yeah, I missed everybody. There was no chance to say goodbye. That was hard. But the kids knew I loved them.
Was the hope that if she recovered, was part of what you felt like you were kind of working for, was for the kids to come back? Was that part of it?
I would hope so, yeah. I mean, the focus was just helping her recover. Yeah, I hoped they would come back. I was just hoping that they might be blocked and that they would come back.
Rhonda was eventually able to leave the hospital, but her insider still didn't come back. Jim took care of her at home for months.
7 months later, she had another stroke, her heart stopped beating. She stopped breathing. Yeah, it was the middle of the night. And I found her unconscious, semi-conscious. And then we just rushed her to the hospital. She died August 7th.
Jim had Rhonda cremated. He gave away some of her ashes to friends who spread the ashes all over the world. And they'd take a picture before they did it and send it back to Jim.
And I've lost a lot of people. You know, we had a lot of little things that we did. You know, like when you have kids, you have little things with each kid. It's different. So I had little different things. What I lost was just the day-to-day interaction. So a person that loses a actual physical child, it's even more. I understand that. It's not the same. But before, like seeing a news report and somebody would talk about losing their child, and I would feel sad for them. But I didn't feel it inside. It wasn't that internal sadness, you know. Now I feel it. It's just different, you know. It's still strong, but it's different.
So we are in your backyard.
Mm-hmm. And so when she died, there was shortly after she died, we had the decom, which is the Burning Man.
It was a perfect day. We stood under a couple of tall California pines next to the pool. There are traces of Rhonda everywhere in Jim's house, but only one place where all of the personalities are commemorated.
This is the little fairy garden area that was one of Rhonda's favorite parts. So we decided to build a memorial to Rhonda because so many people in the community knew her. And so we built a little structure, and on the front of the structure were three columns that had crystals embedded in them that with lights behind them that flanked off and on. And each one got the name of somebody, one of Rhonda's insiders. And so they would all be a part of...
The columns are over 6 feet tall. They're covered with names from top to bottom. There's a rhinestone that shimmers next to each of them. One for Jimmy, one for Abigail, one for each of the triplets, for Lilu and Numbers and Isaiah. A rhinestone for every kid and companion and friend that Jim lost when Rhonda's one body died.
So how long ago did she pass?
3 years ago. Yeah, it comes up every so often.
That you feel it?
Yeah. Yeah. I try to focus on the really happy times. It's not just losing one person. Yeah. And I lost a family. Miss them a lot.
Big thanks to Jim Bunkelman for sharing his story with The Snap. Jim works with several organizations that support the idea of healthy multiplicity. His views are not necessarily the views of this show, but if you'd like to learn more about his world, you can find out more information on our website, snapjudgment.org. The original score for this story was created by Leon Morimoto. It was produced by Julia DeWitt. Now, right after the break, a chicken like you've never heard of before, and the worst breakup of all. And if you're just tuning in, don't miss what you just missed. Get the podcast at snapjudgment.org. Snap Judgment, the Better Half episode, continues in just a moment. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Better Half episode. For our next story, we're going to stretch the conceptual underpinning of the show a little bit in referring to the Better Half. You'll understand what I mean shortly, but please note, vegans may be disturbed by some of the imagery in this next piece, but everyone else is going to love it because sometimes, urban legends are true. Snap Judgment.
So this story is brought to us courtesy of Troy.
Troy Waters.
He's a farmer.
Been farming pretty much all my life. Still right here in Fruta.
That's Fruta, Colorado. It's a small town just outside of Grand Junction. And the business runs in the family. He farms, his father farmed, his grandfather farmed. But the family member he learned the most about farming from is Lloyd.
Lloyd was my mom's grandpa. And I spent probably as much or more time with him when I was younger, growing up, than I did my own dad. And he was a hard man. Let me put it that way. Ornery. Had a mean streak. But he taught me how to shoot. Taught me how to skin. Taught me how to trap. The other thing he taught me is he taught me how to drown the skunk and resuscitate it.
Wait, what does that even mean?
He showed me, he says, well, if any of your buddies ever fall in the canal and drowned, I'm going to show you how to bring him back to life. And we caught a skunk in the trap and drug it over there to the ditch, and he drowned the dang thing. And then showed me how to pump its chest and get it to coughing, you know, get it back to life.
Why a skunk? Isn't that terribly dangerous? Like, why not a I don't know, something, some other small mammal that won't.
I think that's just what we had to have in the trap that day when he thought of it.
And as a kid, are you, when he's teaching you this stuff as a kid, are you like rolling your eyes or are you like freaking out?
One thing, you didn't roll your eyes around somebody like him. He'd whack you upside the head for rolling your eyes.
So that was Lloyd. Mean, but caring, and practical to a fault. If you're a kid growing up on a farm, and you want to farm yourself, it would be hard to find a better mentor. But remember, he wasn't even really Troy's grandfather. He was his great-grandfather, an old guy.
And he finally got to the point where, well, he started going blind. He had a minor stroke. Mom moved him in with us, and me and Grandpa's bedrooms were downstairs next to each other. And I spent a lot of nights sitting on the edge of his bed, listening to him. He'd want to start talking and telling stories. There's several times my mom come down to wake me up for school, and she'd find me. I'd be laying in there on the floor in my grandpa's room or on the foot of his bed, because that's where I fell asleep listening to him. And it was when we was living with him that I actually found my grandmother's scrapbook that she kept of Mike the Headless Chicken.
Now, if you don't know about Mike the Headless Chicken, don't worry. At this point, Troy didn't either. All he knew was that in this scrapbook, there were pages of clippings, correspondence, family photos of his grandfather, Lloyd, with what appeared to be a chicken with no head. But in all his late-night chats, Lloyd had never mentioned anything about a headless chicken. So Troy went and asked his mom, "What's the deal?"
She goes, "Oh yeah, that's, you know, something that happened right before I was born, and Grandpa really don't like talking about it much." And I go, "Okay." But one of those nights when he was wanting to visit, I got the story out of him.
The story takes place right there in Fruta in 1945. Back then, Lloyd was raising fryers.
Fryers, a chicken that's raised, you know, for slaughter. And the day that it was time to slaughter him, you know, he'd reach down in there and grab one by the legs, throw it on the stump, whack its head off with an axe, and flip it over on the ground, let it bleed out. And, you know, he says, you know, you always had one. You cut the head off, and they make it back to its feet. That's where the expression come from, you know, run around with chicken with your head cut off, is because they would do that.
Troy says that a good run for a chicken with its head cut off is 4, maybe 5 minutes, max. Then it dies.
But when he got done, a couple hours later, this one last chicken was still standing there without a head.
And the chicken? It looked fine. It wasn't bleeding. For the past 2 hours, it had just been walking around like normal, headless.
So he figured, what the heck, let's see if it'll live till morning. He put it in an old wooden apple box, set it on the back porch, and the next morning he got up and the thing was still alive. He was amazed that, you know, that's been alive for almost a day now. This shouldn't be happening. So he's hitched up the team of horses, loaded up, you know, all the dead chickens to take them into town. He took this one with him in the apple box and started betting guys a beer that he had a live chicken without a head. And, of course, they expected it to, you know, be dead at any time. It wasn't until day three that people started realizing how bizarre it really was.
I'm just curious, like, what was it? What was the chicken physically like to look at?
He looked normal. Grandpa said he acted normal. When he cut it off, basically, I think he dang near missed, and he cut it high. So when he cut the head off, he left the base of the brain stem and actually one eardrum. So it still could hear. It'd still get startled, you know, with a loud noise or something. It still tried walking around. It would still try to prune itself with the stump of its head.
Oh, no.
You know, it was a rooster.
Right.
A male chicken. So it would still, Grandpa said it'd still try to crow, and it'd make a gurgling sound.
How did Lloyd feed it then?
They fed it right down its gullet with, you know, your old-fashioned glass eyedropper.
And that would have been the chicken's life. Preening, gurgling, ingesting. Were it not for what happened next.
About 2 weeks later, that's when it caught the attention of a gentleman in the business of promoting sideshows. His name was Hope Wade.
and the sideshow promoter had a proposition for Lloyd.
He told Grandpa, says, you know, we could travel around the country with this thing and you could make a little money off of it. And, you know, that was right at the end of the Great Depression. And Grandpa was still pretty much farming with horse and mule.
So he took Hope Wade up on his offer. And it was a good thing he did, because it turned out that Hope Wade was... there's no other term for it. He was a marketing genius. Because he didn't just throw this chicken into the sideshow circuit right away. It's more like he rolled him out. Phase one was to give this chicken some credentials, to make it more than just an urban legend. So he took it to a university, a biolab in Salt Lake.
And the scientists there surgically removed the heads of several chickens to try to duplicate the chicken's condition and never got any of them to live for any length of time.
Now that the chicken was a bona fide scientific phenomenon, that allowed Wade to initiate phase two, the press. He got Life magazine to come and take pictures.
Hope Wade says, well, we need the head. Well, Lloyd never thought about keeping the head. So the head that's in all the photographs was not his true head. It was donated by another chicken.
And if you look at the Life magazine photos, you can see why Wade was onto something here. There's the body, and right there on the ground next to it, there's its head, staring at you, looking almost kind of forlorn.
Hope Wade's also the one that come up with the name, Miracle Mike, the Headless Chicken.
Did he have any name before that?
No.
With phase three completed, Wade declared that Miracle Mike was ready for the big time. Or, I guess, the small time, because, you know, it's a sideshow.
They had him in a tent, and they would have callers, is what they called them, standing out front. Grandpa said they'd usually take turns, either him or Hope Wade, to try to convince people to pay their two bits to come inside and actually see. His only problem was when people would come in, most of the time he'd just sit there in the straw like it was asleep. Because in Mike's world, it was always night. And they'd have to prod it and get it walking around and, you know, try to make it active to prove that it wasn't dead. Some people were amazed, some people were horrified, but, you know, part of what made Miracle Mike work was Grandpa was there, because he was the man that swung the axe.
The man and his chicken proved an irresistible combination. Mike was a hit. In Salt Lake, in Phoenix, on the boardwalk in Long Beach. At some point, there was a whole tour of the South.
And at his peak, Mike was probably making several thousand dollars a week.
A year passed, a year and a half, and Mike's fame spread far and wide.
There's letters that are only addressed to the owners of Mike the Headless Chicken 200 miles west of Denver. And them letters found their way to my grandparents. Some of them were good. Most of the letters Grandma kept were hate mail. There's one letter that actually compares my grandparents to the Nazis for their cruelty of letting Mike live. You know, and I did ask Grandpa about that. I said, what do you think about that? And he goes, oh, hell. He goes, you know, that chicken had the best life of any chicken. He says, it was nurtured. And his words were, got to see more of the country than any other chicken ever got to see, even though it didn't have a head.
Did Floyd or Wade, did either of them ever develop feelings for Mike?
I'm sure they did. I mean, how could you not? It had to have been taken care of like you'd take care of an infant, a baby. You know, so I'm sure you'd develop feelings for it. Did Grandpa ever admit that to me? No. That wasn't the kind of man he was.
And during this time, was there any sign that Mike was, like, flagging?
No. He was doing good. But one day, Grandpa came back home from the sideshow, and he didn't have Mike with him.
So everyone asked him, what happened?
And he'd always claimed that he'd sold it. Just told everybody that he got tired of traveling all around the country, and it was fun for a little bit, but he was ready to come back to the farm. Somewhere around 2 years after, one of the local newspapers asked Grandpa if he'd heard from Mike and if Mike was still doing good. And he goes, oh, yeah, he's still doing good and still traveling around the world. But he never did say how much he sold it for. and everybody thought that my grandfather had made millions. And it wasn't until one day, sometime in the 80s, a lady from the local newspaper called up and she asked him who he sold it to. And he says, "I didn't sell it, it died." And I remember my mother was in the kitchen, peeking her head around real wild-eyed and looking at me. And I looked back at her because that was the first she'd ever heard of it. And, you know, that intrigued me. Well, what happened, Grandpa? And he finally broke down and he actually had got a tear in his eye. And he says, "Well, I let it die. It's my fault." What happened is when they had it in Phoenix at a sideshow, they brought it back to the motel room with them. And that night it started choking. And they, you know, woke him up and they went to get the bulb syringe to clear his throat. And they had forgot it at the sideshow. And before they could find anything to clear its throat, it choked to death on him.
And what did he do with Mike's body?
I would assume that it ended up flipped out in the desert somewhere between here and Phoenix. And I think he always felt that, you know, it was his fault. He's the one that left the bulb syringe at the sideshow. And he let the goose that was laying the golden egg die on him.
And as for all the money Lloyd did manage to make before Mike died?
Grandpa's exact words to me is that the government took most of it in taxes. Hope Wade took his cut, and he made enough money that he modernized his farm. And he bought him a brand new pickup, which I still own today. But that was pretty much it.
After that, there was no money left. Lloyd went back to farming. By all accounts, he was never able to replicate his former success.
But knowing Lloyd the way I knew him growing up, I'm sure that every time he swung an axe again, I'm sure that was in the back of his mind.
What about you? Have you ever tried?
Have I ever tried? No, I have not. Has the thought crossed my mind? Yeah. Just as a laughing thought. But no, I think if I did one today and actually lived, I don't know if I'd let it live. I think I'd finish the job.
Troy Walters, still working on his family-owned farm in Fruta, Colorado. For more information about Mike and his legacy, visit our website at snapjudgment.org. The original score for that piece was by Renzo Gorio, with additional instrumentation by Andrew Vickers. That piece was produced by Headless Joe Rosenberg. When Snap Judgment returns, we know that relationships are hard, but what if you can never, ever walk away? When Snap Judgment, the Better Half episode continues, stay tuned. From WNYC, welcome back to Snap Judgment, the Better Half episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and today we're exploring the idea of having your better self be someone else entirely. And Snappers, we know that it's hard to break up. Always, 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 always. But what if breaking up wasn't even an option? Come aboard with me right now on the Snap Trolley as we travel into our own imagination land. Snap Judgment.
Text her. Maybe she'd be happy to hear from me. I'll text her. "Hey, I'm gonna come by later to bring some stuff over. Cool?" No word at 8 or 9 or 9:30. I'll call her.
"Hey, it's Claire. Leave me a message after the beep.
Hey, it's me. I have these books you wanted back. I mean, you really wanted them back, and okay, you don't have to talk to me. You can just have your books. Okay, bye. Oh, damn it. 10:30. No word. I grab my keys and the box of her books and head out. Hey.
Hi.
Did you get my text?
No, I was out.
Oh. What were you up to?
You know what I was up to, Dan.
No, I don't.
I was on a date. That's what I was up to.
You what?
What do you mean, what? We broke up months ago. This is what you do when you break up. You see other people. You should try it.
How was it?
No, no. Ugh. We're not going there. Look, it's late. You can't just show up like this. You know that. Sorry.
Your books. They're all here. You wanted them back? Remember?
Yeah, like 6 months ago. You refused to give them back to me.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. Hey, this one was a gift.
Yeah, well... How are you?
I'm okay. Yeah, I'm good. Just kind of, you know, doing this and that. Still at the restaurant. How are you?
Oh, good. Yeah, you know, it's been tough, but I'm hanging in there. Did you get my texts?
I blocked your phone number after you internet stalked that first guy I was dating, remember? You wouldn't stop texting me about him.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, yeah. Things have really been a lot better lately. I feel like I've really figured some things out. You know, all that stuff from before, I've pretty much got it all figured out. So I'm great.
Yeah.
God, Claire, I miss you. I miss you so much. Are you alone?
Mm-hmm.
Can I come up?
I really don't think that's a good idea.
Come on. Just for a second, I want to see our place.
My place.
Yeah, your place. Just, please, just for a second.
Okay.
When we were together and I couldn't sleep, I would listen to Claire breathing. She always slept so well, so deeply. Nothing seemed to be able to keep her up. I listen now. She's breathing low and slowly. Every few exhales, she lets out a tiny snore. I curl my body around hers, kiss her shoulder blade, hold her around her middle, grab her hand. She scoots closer to me. I don't want to fall asleep.
Dan! Dan, wake up! Oh my God,
what?
Dan, wake up!
What's wrong? Are you okay?
No, look!
Claire yanks my hand and holds it up in front of my face, and then I see it. My hand is her hand, or our hands are melded together, and when she pulls on our shared skin, it hurts. Stop! Oh my God, that hurts!
Yeah, it does hurt! What did you do, Dan?
What? No, I've never seen anything like this before.
Well, get up! Get up!
Why?
Why? We're going to the emergency room. How are you not freaked out right now?
I'm freaked out. I was kind of asleep.
Well, I'm calling a cab.
I mean, do we have to do it right away? Maybe we could have breakfast together.
Oh my God, I can't even believe you right now. Get up! We are going to the hospital.
Wait, I have to go to the bathroom first.
Ugh.
Dan? Claire? Okay, I'm gonna need to ask you a few questions before we take you to see the doctor. Because we can't separate you two, I'm gonna ask you some intake questions while you're both in the same room, okay?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I'm just looking at your intake form. It says your skin is fused together.
Yes. Claire, it's okay. It's gonna be okay.
Just leave me alone. Please.
And when did this happen?
Last night, I think.
So within the last 24 hours?
Yep.
And have either of you had anything to drink in the last 24 hours or, you know, any drugs?
Nope.
Yes.
And have either of you had intercourse in the last 24 hours?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Are you in a relationship with each other?
No.
It's complicated.
No, we're not.
Are you in pain?
Yeah.
Yeah, right here, right between our hands.
Okay, I'm just gonna look at the affected area. Do you mind showing me your hands? Okay, so I see some discoloration and inflammation on the skin between your hands here, and I could feel that it's quite hot. And I'm also seeing something here, Dan. You have a scar on the other side of your hand. Have you had any surgery on your palm or fingers before?
No.
Okay, I'm pulling up your history. Huh. It says you were here last year with Rose Washienko.
Wait, what?
You came in with an identical complaint, but your skin was fused with Miss Washienko's on the opposite side of your hand? And it looks like this also happened in 2008 with Miss Melville Sanchez, but it was on your right shoulder.
What? You mean that scar's not from your bike accident?
So we just get the same thing done, like last time?
Yep, mm-hmm, and the time before that.
Oh my god.
I'm gonna get the doctor, okay? we'll take care of this.
Okay, thanks.
Are you kidding me?
I just want you.
Ugh.
But we're so good together.
No, we're not. That's why we broke up in the first place. That's why I'm seeing other people.
I love you.
Look, Dan, I need to be with someone who doesn't need me, who just wants me around, but not all the time.
I don't want you around all the time.
I couldn't shower without you in the room. I couldn't go out with my friends without you texting every 5 minutes. I couldn't go on a work trip.
I calmed it down.
You should be single for a while. It'd be good for you.
You don't know what's good for me.
Okay, we're ready for you.
So now you're saying it's broken three places?
This thing itches so bad. I gotta wear it for like 6 weeks.
6 weeks, huh?
I don't mean to do this. I really don't. I just fall so hard. And
yeah.
I love Claire, even though she's gone.
Nah, I hear you, man. That all sounds rough. Can I get you something, or...?
Just a beer. Thanks.
You got it.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Oh my gosh, are you hurt?
Oh, yeah, this, I just went through surgery.
Wow, pretty recently, huh?
Yeah, last week.
I'm so sorry.
Hey, you here with anybody? I'd love to buy you a drink.
yeah. Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Hey, can we get another round over here?
Yep, got you.
So, what was the surgery for?
Well, I was on my bike.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at this intersection, and there was this lady in her car, and I really liked her dog. But then I started looking at it, and a car came from the other direction, and I didn't see it coming, and it hit me on the side.
Ouch.
And so I tumbled off the bike, but I broke my fall with my hand and scraped up real bad on the gravel.
I'm happy to tell you, Snappers, there is no man running around your town doing this sort of thing, at least as far as we know. The piece was adapted from a story by our dear friend, Anders Howerton. Find out more about Anders' work on our website, snapjudgment.org. Big thanks to our players, Sam Fishman, Julia DeWitt, Eliza Smith, Pat Mesiti-Miller, and Davey Kim. The original score for that story was created by Pat Mesiti-Miller. It was produced by Eliza Smith. Yup, it's that time. But did you know it's not over until you say it's over?
because we've got full episodes awaiting your pleasure. Amazing stories right now on the podcast. Subscribe at snapjudgment.org. Hit me on Facebook, hit me on Twitter, because we're having a Snap Nation convocation. Snap was produced by the same team that originally thought up the character Jar Jar Binks. Show him some love. Mark, the Uber-producer, Ristich. Pat Mancini Miller, Anna Sussman, Julie DeWitt, Joe Rosenberg, Nancy Lopez, Davey Kim, Renzo Gorio, the Snap Judgment Cybernetic Systems Administrators, Eliza Smith, Leon Morimoto, Matt DeCotton, Anna Adlerstein, Jasmine Aguilera sees her better half in the mirror every day. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting likes molasses sandwiches. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you can wake up face down in a pool of diet soda only to realize that you don't know what this stuff is, but it ain't diet soda. You can do that and still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC.